want insight and solutions? You're in for a unique experience, one where you're free to ask questions about where you're stuck, ask and hear questions of an everyday variety, global or personal, deep or ancient. All questions are welcome. Any human issue or problem is seen with a new awareness from Patricia's powerful understanding of whole brain thinking. Receive insights you never thought were possible, and be comforted to hear some insights you always knew were right. Discover the profound and the creative value that problems can give us. And now, Patricia's son.
Welcome to Trust the Problem. Today on Trust the Problem, we're going to talk, I think, about Thomas Jefferson. I was going to go in an entirely different direction, but as I was looking up some old quotes that I had picked up along the time, there was just so much there. So I'm Patricia Sun, and today on Trust the Problem, I'm really going to talk about the problem in our world right now, particularly in America, and about democracy and our government. And it's really off the cuff because, as I say, it was like a last-minute shift as I was looking at some wonderful quotes from Thomas Jefferson. And it just struck me that we're in a crisis, which is, as the ancient Chinese ideograph says, a combination of danger and opportunity, and which Al Gore mentioned, by the way, in his movie *An Inconvenient Truth*, about this old ideograph in ancient Chinese, where there's a wisdom built into the symbol. And if we know that when there's a crisis going on, when things look scary or dangerous, or there's a problem or something needs to be attended to right away, it's a wake-up call. It's something that causes us to look again, to think once more, to see it with fresh eyes. And interestingly, the word respect means re-see, to look again, to look a little deeper. And that's what respect is. And to have respect for one another, to look a little deeper into each person, is very much like the old Indian saying, you walk a mile in a man's moccasins before you judge him. That there is this need for empathy as an aspect of intelligence. That when we are empathetic, we have a sense of more than just our position. We get to see other points of view that are not just ideological or power grabs or need to control others, but actually real, honest, true information about how someone else sees something. And that is very much part of our maturity, to be able to do that. I think I really should title this show Maturity and Thomas Jefferson, because the maturity issue is a theme, a constant theme in my work, that we're in the midst of an evolutionary leap, and that what that really means is that collectively as a species, human beings are maturing, and the species is maturing, and what that looks like is that we're moving from just that biological supremacy, power over dominating kind of mentality that's a survival driven on automatic pilot, not through conscious reflection. And I think of most other animals, especially mammals, but almost all animals have this drive. And just recently I was watching a series on Animal Planet with called Meerkat Manor, and they had a, I just saw part of it, but they had a female, so the dominant female meerkat, and they were describing that she was considering killing the babies of these other two females, just in case there's not enough food, she's going to kill off their babies so that her babies would survive. And I thought, you know, since the meerkat does that, then obviously that is not just an anthropomorphic or a dominancy, there's herd mentality, there's a hierarchy, there's a power distribution, and you know what's the old saying, to the winner belongs the spoils, well, to the fittest, you know, Darwin's idea that the fittest dominate and survive and the others don't. That is in nature, and it's true, and it's observable, and the more you observe nature, you see it. But you also see that it comes about because these animals can't think higher into the issue of the overview, into the issue of love, into the issue of being able to see yourself as part of a bigger whole. And it's driven more by instinct. A lot of things we call instinct that aren't really instinct. They are thought. They are biological drives, but combined with love. And love is a power. It's part of, I think animals feel love, but I think human beings can feel love at a much more complex and refined level, which includes intelligence, so that love actually becomes a form of intelligence and maturity, their capacity to love. So when I was looking at Thomas Jefferson quotes, to get back to what I said started with here, there was the first thing that really got me was this quote, and I've heard it before, sometimes in the context of slavery, sometimes not. But in this particular quote, Thomas Jefferson says, "I have never been able to conceive how any rational being could propose happiness to himself from the exercise of power over others." Now that's a very mature statement. It's a very evolved consciousness that you actually, from the point of the way you're looking at things, the way you're seeing, the way you're empathizing, your level of knowledge, experience, and goodwill makes it clear rationally, not just intuitively or feelingly, but rationally it makes it clear that you cannot be happy, contrary to almost everything that's very prominent in our culture right now, you actually cannot be happy by trying to have power over other people. And I believe that we're evolving from a place of immature, primitive primate thinking, which is about domination and control and power over, to one of maturity, where we not only don't want power over other people, we want to empower people to be their best selves. There's a thing, let me see if I can remember, I used to say all the time in my workshop, something I made up a long time ago, which is, what is the most powerful position you can take in the world? What's the most powerful position? And the most powerful position is to be happy and pleased with everyone having all their power. Because then we come from wholeness, from healthiness, from freedom, from sanity, from maturity, everyone. So that the most powerful place is to be safe and comfortable, being aware that if everyone has all their power, then we're not functioning from jealousy and short-sighted thinking and domination and power over other people as a kind of psychological software or base of operation. And right now, because we're insecure and because we've let a lot of time go by not practicing our democracy in the sense of the people being educated and informed and knowledgeable and in charge of the government. So, bit by bit, we've really relinquished the people's power. And there's a quote on that, and see if I can find it quickly. I got so carried away, I was kicking out quite a few of them. can't find the one I was looking for, but here's a couple that sort of all speak to it. He says, I had rather ask an enlargement of power from the nation, which means the people, where it is found necessary, than to assume it by a construction which would make our powers boundless, which is to make the government boundless. He says, I do verily believe that a single consolidated government would become the most corrupt government on the earth. So having a single consolidated government is by definition corrupt because it is so absolute. And he says the peculiar happiness of our blessed system is that in differences of opinion between these different sets of servants, the different forms of government within our government, the appeal is to neither, but to their employers, peaceably assembled by the representatives in convention, which means the people are represented. But if the people don't care or don't know, and if they don't exercise their power to vote, or which is abysmal in the United States, I've forgotten the particular facts, data on that, but it's atrocious. You know, way more than half the people don't vote. And if you don't vote, if there's not even an interest in voting, then there's not a chance to correct, even if you don't like who's available. Even if you do end up picking a lesser, quote-unquote, of two evils, you're putting the light of your intention, you're putting the light of your citizenhood, your power as a being in the nation to care, to observe, to take account. And these days, it's pretty hard even to know who someone is, because we've got tremendous media, but it's all used in sound bites and with money and with focus groups and little phrases meant to incite the people against the other person or for something. Usually it's against. And I don't know if this is the quote I was looking for before. It says, enlighten the people generally. Yeah. And tyranny and oppressors of body and mind will vanish like spirits at the dawn of day. So enlightening the people is the most important job we have. And to enlighten the people means to enlighten yourself. You have the most power over you, and one of the things I've always said is there's nobody sitting in there but you, and this is your body, yourself, your selfhood is the piece of the planet that you have complete control over. So enlightening yourself is a very worthy endeavor. And sharing what you learn, not in a dominating, controlling way or judgmental way, but just as part of being human, allows our growth collectively. And it's very, very important that we see that, because if we despair, and as Al Gore mentioned even again in The Inconvenient Truth about the global warming issue in his movie, that people move from denial, not wanting to look at it, and sort of, I would almost say, kind of like the, you know, the Roman circus amuse the people, and then the government can do what it wants. And so we're very entertainment-oriented, very much oriented to just escaping. So first there's denial. And then if you start to look at something that's really important and you see it's become a mess because we haven't been looking at it, then we move into despair. And that's just as bad almost as denial. Denial, you don't even know. You can't even begin to solve a problem and you can be easily fooled. Despair robs you of your life force. And that's what's the problem with it. And of course, there's a huge space in between denial and despair. Huge. And that's where all the creativity is. And that's where all the new discovery is. And that's where we help each other. And that's where we let our intuition tell us thoughts never thought before. It's where we become creative and discover new realities, new solutions, and just plain become more educated. And this is the quote I was looking for. If once the people become inattentive to the public affairs, you and I in Congress and assemblies, judges and governors, shall all become wolves. It seems to be the law of our general nature in spite of individual exceptions. And so this is really the piece. This is the next step. And we are in a kind of a crisis. We are in a crisis environmentally. We are in a crisis governmentally. We're in a crisis economically. We're in a crisis in education. We're in a crisis in healthcare. We're in a social crisis of consciousness about what do we collectively care about. This is a very important thing. And we have every right as human beings to feel overloaded and overwhelmed and need to kind of take a break, escape for a while. That's okay. It's just you can't do it permanently. And you have to sort of replenish by not being stressed and then step back in. And I think this maturity issue is about finding ways to be conscious in a complex way of the many, many issues that are going on without being overwhelmed. And it is interesting that we're not overwhelmed, particularly when we begin reflection, when we begin to consider that, how can I say this? Well, I'll say it how I mean it. Which is, there is a God, and there is an order to the universe. It's not a person sitting on a cloud judgmentally, you know, punishing people or not helping them. It is actually, that's an anthropomorphic. That's a kind of making God like a person, a petty person at that. God actually, to me, is all that is. It's the natural law of the universe. It's the order of the galaxies and the molecules and the atoms, and it's the impulses and it's the guidelines and it's the nature of nature. And one of the characteristic portals or contact points with God is love. That when you feel love, you feel the connection to that greater awareness. And that is a real thing that we have made small. Religions have made it small and political. Our mind, our mental processes have made it small in terms of, you know, the range of our own natural thinking, or maybe this immature primate kind of thinking that we're trying to evolve out of. And I want to talk just a little bit more about that immature primate thinking. One of my favorite stories to tell is something I saw on the Scientific American program that Alan Alda hosted. I believe it was that one. And they had they had some chimpanzees that were being studied, you know, their intelligence and problem solving and so on. And the test was really about reading and math. And so they had symbol pictures that they could press, and they used jelly beans, I think it was, little pieces of candy, to pay off the chimp when they got the right answer. And as they were doing all this, they discovered that, you know, the chimp knew, like, the symbol three meant three jelly beans. They learned that really fast. they could read three real fast, or four or five or six, whatever, because you put up the number and then they got that number of jelly beans. They soon learned the bigger numbers gave more jelly beans. Really right into that. They got that okay. But the interesting thing was that they decided to just do this extra little experiment, because they usually use two chimps. And what they did is they put a little twist on it, so that they had one chimp who was going to receive the jelly beans, and the other chimp was going to receive jelly beans, but the jelly beans that the chimp that chose got was whatever, in other words, whatever he chose, the other chimp got. And what he didn't choose, could be two choices, one bigger, one smaller, what he didn't choose would go to the other chimp. So they knew about quantity, they knew about the numbers, but their little fingers could not choose the smaller number. They wanted the bigger amount so much, even as they started to learn that whatever they chose went to the other chimp, and they got what was left, which was always the smaller one. You know, you'd see their face be dejected. You'd hear the woman who was, you know, doing the experiment say, "Oh, poor Sally, she didn't get the you gave them to Mary. Look what you did." You know, it got so funny that they were getting right down to it, what was happening, and you could see the chimp knew, but his finger, or her finger, I don't know if he or she, I really don't remember, but they couldn't resist pressing the button or the symbol or the pointing to the bigger quantity. That's what it was. They actually saw it in front of them, the small quantity and the big quantity. And when there was the big quantity, their finger just had to point to it. Now, I kind of think that's where we are some of the time. You know, we're in that kind of unevolved primate consciousness where we just do things that totally hurt ourselves because short term it looks like we'll get more. And it's why I think people follow and always have followed people who have more money. You know, and I think of Abraham Lincoln who said, "Let us hope that we will not believe or live as though might makes right." But might does make right for most people, and that's that primitive primate consciousness. And it's one of the hurdles of awareness that we have to kind of get into concrete terms with, because I've seen parents brutalize their children, not because they really just wanted to brutalize their children. I could see they even loved their children. There's a great program on I saw recently, too, about honey, were killing the kids. And it showed this husband and wife, both overweight with three little girls, and they're bringing in bad food, they're making bad food. It's all greasy and fried and junk food, and it's what they're providing because they want it, because they're still in rebellion. They're still in that early primate consciousness when they couldn't have it. Now they're big, they can have it. And even in some ways, they can let their kids have it as a mirror of their own inner kid. So it's not the big picture that this is harmful, that it's causing diabetes and all kinds of disease and early aging. They don't see that bigger picture because they're still like the little chimp with their finger pointing to the bigger pile, in this case, to the candy and the greasy food. It's just as though that's what they need to have. You know, they need to have it. And so that's the next step. That's the piece that we're moving away from, being able to see it in so many levels. And in this program, what they did, too, is they used computer graphics to age these sweet little girls. They're so cute. And they aged them in the way they would be if they were overweight and malnourished. Fit. And, you know, it circles under their eyes, and they really looked awful at age 40. So, this see the father, he was so, he said, oh, it's my fault, it's my fault. He used to love to fry things in a deep fryer. And so even though habits were hard, impulses didn't change all of a sudden, you could see there was this big oversight view, this big overview into time, into consequences, and they began to see the bigger picture. And out of a love for their children, which they really had, even though they were harming them terribly, they were harming themselves in the same terrible way. So it wasn't something they could actually see, because they had blinders on, because they were operating out of that primitive level. So what I really think we're faced with, a lot of what we call government, is not really about government. It's about it's about our own maturity and the polarized thinking, the simplistic thinking, which keeps us at that monkey mind, keeps us at that level of immature primate, where we are greedy, where we are envious, where we feel jealous if somebody has more than us, more in fame, more in money, more in looks, more in health, more in talent, whatever. And then we're mean and cruel to people who do well, unless we can be subservient to them because we think we're going to get some of their fame or their money. This is immature thinking. This is what our founding fathers really didn't have too much of. They were evolved thinkers. And that's why it seemed irrational to want to have power over someone else, to Thomas Jefferson. And I just happen to have sitting in front of me another quote, so I'm going to go to it. It's a little bit, well, it's all part of the same thing. In this quote, he says, "It is the old practice of despots to use a part of the people to keep the rest in order. And those who have once got an ascendancy, sort of there in charge and in power, and possessed themselves of all the resources of the nation, their revenues and offices, have immense means for retaining their advantage." So, let me just say that one more time. It's the old practice of despots to use part of the people to keep the rest in order. And those who have once got an ascendancy and possessed themselves of all the resources of the nation, the revenues and offices, have immense means for retaining their advantages. And this means, and this is where we are right now, we're like hovering with polarized thinking, Republicans and Democrats, but more the extreme right, extreme left. I used to always say in my workshops for decades that, you know, the extreme right and extreme left are the same. They are the people who feel powerless and who are excessive and who want power over others. There are liberal Republicans and there are liberal Democrats. There are Democrats who are more, because of the two kinds of the ways the polarities separate, the Republican neocon being very dominating and controlling, the Democrats do their own amount of controlling, but it's sort of not as obvious. It's sort of like in the name of the people, but it's still a lot of decisions behind closed doors. It's still about an elite running things, just the way in communist countries, you know, it's supposedly all for the people. It's everybody, you know, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, which is a wonderful thought, but not practiced ever in so-called communist countries or even socialist countries, because that is a function of maturity of thinking, not political organization. It's a function of awareness. And what had happened in Russia and the Soviet Union and in China and in North Korea and many of the communist countries is that the psychology of peasant king, the psychology of, you know, poor ordinary person who's controlled by the aristocracy, that psychology did not mature enough. it matured somewhat, but not enough. And in fact, Japan, interestingly, did a different thing in its maturing process. It had the feudal system too. It had the king and the warlords and the peasants who were really slaves. You know, peasants were slaves throughout Russia and China and most of the world. When you say a peasant, you really meant people who really had very little rights and were owned by their lord, by the person who owned the land they lived on, and they could be killed even. It was slavery. It's just another word that makes it a little distant, but it really was. And so what Japan had as its psychology, and I'm making a case for a lot of what we're doing in the world as a human psychological problem more than a political one, and I'll even go into the political word in a minute, unless I can remind myself. But the psychological issue is one of maturity, and the immature thinks like monkey mind, early primates. It thinks like primates that are unevolved. It thinks domination, hierarchical. Those of the lower hierarchy are expendable for the support of those in domination. And I remember Senator when he retired, Phil Graham. And he was caught in the halls of Congress by C-SPAN as he was leaving, you know, in the last days. And he was kind of jovial and happy and pleased with himself when he was leaving. He thought, you know, he was the senator. So he says, in passing almost, he says, well, you know, people in America just don't know what democracy is. And, of course, the C-SPAN interviewer, being very tuned in to just the question, says, well, what is it? And he said, well, democracy is whoever wants it most gets it. And I remember thinking, being so shocked that he, so pleased with himself, educating the nation about democracy. It's the greedy. Democracy belongs to the greedy, whoever wants it most, whoever's most ruthless, who most wants it. And you most want power over others when you're immature, insecure, fearful, and enough is never enough. Nothing is ever enough. The power is endless. That's why it always leads to despotism, as Thomas Jefferson was saying. And that one of the tools the despots have always used, through Julius Caesar on and before, is to pit people against one another, start a war, get people fearful. And I do believe that creating fear inside of people is the greatest sin. It is, and the antidote is creating love and empathy and comprehension and goodwill, so that we can become creative and make solutions, taking into account lots of different people's needs and points of view. So this is the next step. And it is our collective awareness of that, our becoming aware of it as a psychological immaturity issue, both in Democrats and Republicans, almost always on the extreme fringes, and can happen to anyone on any situation where they feel particularly powerless or fearful. That's when we get most polarized. It's the fight or flight biological response when you feel powerless. And I used to say in my workshops all the time that I believe that the greatest lie that we tell ourselves, the greatest lie that we believe that causes so much harm, is the lie that says we have no power. We have awesome power all the time, every minute, as long as you're breathing and thinking, you have power. I used to say if you're sitting in an iron lung, which don't really have very many of these anymore, I don't think, but if, even if you're just physically paralyzed. And even I think of Christopher Reeve, paralyzed from the neck down, ready to die and give it all away because he felt so terrible. And with the love of his wife and family and other people and the respect people still had, and with the growing maturity of our own species, we began to see this archetype man who was Superman, paralyzed now from the neck down, became an archetype of another kind of power. The power of the will, the power of love, the power of caring, the power of focusing on solving the problem. And that's what I mean by trust a problem. I don't mean it's, well, it is good to be a problem. I don't think all problems are good, and I think, you know, we want to get rid of a lot of problems as quickly as possible. But it's how we get rid of them and how we use them to become more wise, to become more mature, to gain new information, to work well with other people, to heal. That's the secret. And so it's so important that we participate. Oh, the other quote that I was looking before for about voting was, it's by their votes the people exercise their sovereignty. So if we don't vote, we relinquish our sovereignty. And one of the sad things that I think is a real concern right now is with this consolidation of power that's been happening. That's immature, by the way, very immature. It's in the media. The media's kind of relinquishing a lot of its rights to corporate interests and narrow thinking. It's the jelly bean thing again. You know, it's the revenues. It's just narrow thinking. And one of the serious problems is that so many of the electronic voting machines are very easy to fix. They have a purpose. Fully left hole, they call it, where if you know the password, or you can get in and you can change it. You can, and it was there to help the software, supposedly, quote unquote, to help the people who build the machines update software so they could get in easily. But they can get in easily, and they can change elections, they can change the voting, and you can be certain they have already done this and that they are planning to do it again, because there's no trace. There's no way to tell. The only way that it got found out last time was that there were more votes cast than there were voters. And by vast, vast percentage, all the votes that got changed, or all the areas where, I should say this way, that all the areas where the exit poll estimates, which are usually quite accurate, they have that down very well, were wrong, they were almost universally in George Bush's favor. And, of course, the companies, the Diebold particularly, president of the Diebold company, said to George Bush, and this is common knowledge, I think, it's quoted out in many areas and not denied because they don't even see it as a problem. He said, well, George, you're going to win on our machines. And apropos of that, I one day would love to put a documentary together about this, but I do remember when Al Gore and George Bush were running, and the Florida exit polls declared Al Gore the winner. And that went on for a little while. And they went to Crawford, I believe it was in Crawford, where George Bush was with his family. And somebody said, NBC or whatever it was, just declared Al Gore the winner in Florida. And George Bush breaks a big smile. And he says, oh, no, that's not right. That's not right. And he looked with that swagger of no concern, I know something you don't know, smile. And I thought he didn't even have enough sense to feign being concerned. So sure was he that he was going to win in Florida, where his brother's the governor, Harris was the voter supervisor, and a of course we all know what happened, or maybe we don't even all know what happened, but in any case, it's not a good sign. It's not a good sign. And it is something to pay attention to. And not to be filled with fear, not despair, not denial, but to have the light really shine on making sure, as a nation, we can afford a paper trail in every election. We can afford a paper trail. We can afford papers that can be counted, numbers that are it's physical votes. And we need to do that. If we want a shorthand, along with the electronic voting, to check, but to have it as a backup, so that we can have a quick analysis, and if there's any contesting, immediately go to the paper trail. This is the solution. It's not rocket science. It's not that hard. And also to have bipartisan control, equal bipartisan control over the machines in every place electronic machines are used. And also a securing of them so that they are under lock and key, so certain people are only responsible for them, so there's accountability. These things are not that hard to solve. The fact that we've gone through since, 6 years, and people are still kind of freaked out about even looking at it. And I have a friend who has a relative who transcribes for news agencies, and she saw a memo that I don't know the details, so I can't get into much trouble because I can't say who it was because I don't know which network, but that they were given a memo that they were not to go there, that the issue of the election being fixed or voting machines being tampered with is not an acceptable story. That's a problem. And it's always better to err on the side of free speech. One of the reasons I got into this Jefferson quotes thing, because I have about 100 pages of Jefferson quotes, but one of the things that I couldn't find that I heard again recently was Thomas Jefferson said, and I'm going to have to paraphrase it because I don't remember it exactly, but it was pretty simple. He basically said, when it comes to the government or the news, the press, having power over the other, I would always prefer the press having power over the government, because that's the only link that the people have. And this latest thing with the New York Times, revealing some of the practices. Well, we really don't know the practice. We only know the superficial generality of it. We don't know if any of the wiretapping or the phone records or the bank records has been used in an inappropriate way. We don't know, because it's all secret. And this is just the press attempting to even give you a heads up that there's something going on, let alone knowing. And that it's somehow going to harm our security, as though terrorists in this country don't know that the government looks at bank records. That's already been talked about. They already know that. So really, it's a power play more than a security issue, in the sense of certainly the security issue in the long run, but it's not a security issue in terms of that immediate thing of whether we know about it or not. We should know about it. This is our government. And, of course, there are certain things that should be done with discretion. But that only has to happen when things are a real mess already. And that's partly where we are. I'm just looking as I've got my computer in front of me, trying to find a letting chance. Here's one. Thomas Jefferson said, one precedent in favor of power is stronger than 100 against it. And that means that anything that power can establish, 100 is stronger than 100 precedents trying to go against it. Because power has the power of the federal government, the power of the presidency, the Congress, the courts, the police, the power that they have is 100 times more powerful. It carries a weight that, to countermand any injustice, requires 100-fold more effort. And that's true. One precedent in favor of power is stronger than 100 against it. And that's from his notes on Virginia in 1782. So this human quality, this human nature, is the issue. And then Thomas Jefferson said, the people are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. No government can continue to do good but under the control of the people. Wherever the people are well informed, they can be trusted with their own government. Whenever things get so far wrong as to attract their notice, they may be relied on to set them to rights. Enlightened people generally, and tyranny and oppressors of body and mind, and will vanish like the spirits of the dawn of the day. And I'm going to say again that one I said earlier, I said that one before too, but I'm going to say this one again. If once the people become inattentive to the public affairs, you and I and the Congress, he's saying you and I as president, you and I and Congress and assemblies, judges and governors shall become wolves. Shall all become wolves. It seems to be the law of our general nature in spite of individual exceptions. Well, I don't think it's so much a law of nature, except it's a law of nature unevolved. It is. We're in a crisis. It's that danger opportunity. The danger is we will not allow ourselves to evolve. We'll devolve. We'll create chaos on the planet with nuclear war and wars and environmental tragedies. This is what we're doing. Because we're not connected, because we're not doing things good for its own sake, because the issue of power over is more important, having more jelly beans than somebody else is more important. This is our immaturity. And we can operate from that place until we so alter the planet that we may just do ourselves in a certain amount of the life on the planet in, and you know, life will evolve again. It will renew itself. The earth will right itself again. It may take another million years. But it will happen. It's just we're so close. We're so close to heaven on earth. And all we have to do is grow up, contemplate what we're doing, do things out of goodwill. Be mature. Let ourselves evolve. Let our fingers point to that which is truly helpful. Give more jelly beans to the other person if you don't need them. But if you need them, choose them. And we don't win by killing off the other. Yeah, it's so amazing to me whenever I talk about this kind of thing. I think about Jesus so much because he was such a miracle of insight in this very area. He was, as Buddha was, an early human, fully human, a mature human being. And a mature human being is kind of always a holy person because you're whole, because you see the goodness, you see the power of love, you see the power of fairness and justice, goodness, and you live it. It's not platitudes, it's not words in order to get power over people or to confuse them or to get money from them. or to get attention by strutting across the stage. It becomes something you live, and that's what keeps you just and honest and kind. And we don't have to do it in every instance, in the sense that the world sometimes is so far behind to just tell the truth, get you crucified. I understand that. But we have to be really careful not to fool ourselves about that. And to really stop and think, how many times we're on automatic pilot to just put somebody else down, or to steal from someone, or to turn a blind eye to the effects of our actions or our thoughts or our words. And everything from how we raise our children and turning ourselves around to see the overview, so we're not defending our egos, our immaturity, our image in the world more than the true well-being of our children. And when we start to see there's a kind of silliness about, I heard Senator, I guess it's good, I can't remember his name, he's from Utah. But anyway, he said today, there's nothing more important than protecting our flag, nothing more important. Well, that's silly. There are many things more important than protecting a piece of cloth. Granted, it's a piece of cloth arranged in a symbolic form that represents our country. But then what you say is nothing more important than protecting our country. But then again, there are things more important than protecting our country. It's protecting the people and the health and the well-being and the honesty in our land. So our country continues. And protected from what? These are just scare, fear-mongering, simplistic thinking thoughts. Of course it's foolish and disrespectful and ugly to desecrate anyone's flag, anyone's symbol of something that matters to them, whether it's religious or political. But to say it's the most important thing in the world is to really show that it's just a simplistic, simple-minded, polarized thought of us and them, and it's like little kids in school and cliques, and you just, it's very adolescent or even pre-adolescent. You don't want to be caught out saying something wrong, or because ooh, when you haven't really thought it out yet. And what I was going to say about politics before that, I made a little note to myself to remember. It's interesting how the word is used these days. I don't have the dictionary definition in front of me, but I do know that politics is the business of the people. Politics comes from the word population, from the populace, from the public. It's the public's work. It's the business of the public. Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. It's like even the word propaganda means the dissemination of information to make a point. Well, that's a good thing. But when propaganda has bad meaning is when it's just a lie or slant to coerce or mislead people, then it's propaganda. And politics now is used as when somebody does something in the government, they say, well, it was just politics. Well, yeah, everything they're doing is politics. But when we say it's just politics, what we're really meaning is it's dishonest for the sake of getting power. And we have melded the two together, which shows that we're not really in touch with the wholesomeness of politics, the necessity of it, the purpose of it, and more importantly, we're not in touch with discerning and saying, well, is this an honest concern or is this a power play concern? That's the more accurate use of the word politics. So, politics is just what you do as human beings to work on things. But what it has evolved to, because it does involve power, is just our hunger and our monkey mind desire just have power over others. We have to be alert to that difference so that we can pick people who maybe sound a little more tedious sometimes because they're giving you more details than you can hold, or people who are earnest and not flamboyant and simplistic minded and don't have the billions of dollars to spend smearing. We have to pay attention. We really have to start looking, because this is a crisis time, but it is a wonderful time. It is the time that's the turning point of our evolutionary leap. It is the time where we wake up, where we disenthrall ourselves, as Abraham Lincoln said when he was talking to the Congress in 18-something, I can't remember now, 52, I think. But he said, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm only going to paraphrase, and I wish I had it in front of me, because he says it so much better than I do. Every time I go to say this, I wish I had it. But he was saying that, and he was talking about slavery and the Civil War and the politics of the time, but we have to disenthrall ourselves from our selfish thinking, and we have to listen to what's good. And then not only will the world be forever grateful to us, God will be forever pleased with what we've done. And this is the power of the moment. And it isn't about strutting around saying things about God. It's about tenderly, gently, kindly, lovingly cultivating the power of it, which is goodness and love and honesty and kindness and straightforwardness. And that's where we're going. And it always entails working on ourselves, which we always have the power to do. So it is in that spirit I wish to leave you, thinking about problems and human maturity and the crisis of our time and our founding fathers and what they knew. They knew about the bloodbaths in Europe. They knew about the polarization and the power grabs of religion and politics. Now's the time to live it. We're ripe. We're ready. And this is Patricia Sun, wishing you love, and thanks for listening to Trust the Problem.
You've been listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. This program and its content is copywritten to Patricia Sun, all rights reserved, 2006.